This is the Eurosnob Podcast.
So in true Arsenal fashion, we go from our best performance since the middle of January, beating West Ham 3-0, to probably the worst performance that any of us can really remember in a 3-0 loss to Palace in a span of 5 days. And if anything can describe that series of events, that is peak Arsenal. Alex, man, this team, they really leave you searching for words sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, the spectrum of emotion that I've gone through with this club, specifically in the last 4 or 5 years, but mostly this season, is just pretty remarkable in the sense that nothing about what happened in the past week and a half has surprised me. And I say that in the worst possible way. Like, nothing about losing 3-0 away to Palace surprised me. Obviously we'll get into both the West Ham game and the Palace game and some of the larger issues around the club. And then certainly we have some Champions League talk towards the end as well. But certainly, I know you had some thoughts about the West Ham game, because that was one that seemed to get a little bit of buzz back into the fan base, only to die a slow and terrible death on Monday.
I mean, what does that tell you about our fan base? That we just want this team to win, because the second we put together a halfway decent performance, everybody is, hey, you know what? Maybe we're onto something. And okay, not everybody, because there's still half the fan base that is screaming for Wenger's head. But the thing from the West Ham game really that made me happy to see was Arsene finally tried to play a 4-3-3. He changed something up. After saying all season that he's tried different things to get it to work, he finally did change it up and he tried something different. And it worked well. You saw Granit Xhaka really look comfortable. And you saw Mesut Ozil in parts of the field where he generally hasn't found himself for us in the last year or so. And it worked. The team flowed. The team held position in midfield, or held possession in midfield. It created chances. And okay, to be fair, it was West Ham, and they haven't been very good. But I don't know. For me, it's. I don't know that it's really a sign, but or you can really take anything out of it. But I like to see it. It made me happy. I think it made me happier than us winning the game 3-0, because as I said 3 weeks ago, results mean nothing to me anymore at this point in time in the season.
Yeah, I think with the 4-3-3, what was interesting is you had that Xhaka Elneny pairing that I've been really curious to see how it would work. And then you did have Ozil dropping deeper, and you could tell that there was an instruction from the manager for Ozil to play a little deeper. And then just, allow that front three to do their thing and to interchange and, have that movement. So, it was one of Xhaka's better games as an Arsenal player. He was really dictating from deep. He got time and space on the ball because he had two guys in midfield who could actually receive it, as opposed to Coquelin, who actively avoids the ball. I mean, it is what it is. And so, a guy like Elneny, who has a good engine, but also is a good passer. Nothing special, but he's a good passer.
But you know what, though, about thinking about him, he really is fun to watch. Because, not fun in the sense that he's going to dribble people or tackle or do anything overly exciting, but from a tactical sense,
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy you can use in a variety of different ways, which I like. And
I think he's just underrated in the sense of his intelligence as a player. He's always looking to make himself available, which is incredibly important, especially for somebody like Xhaka, where he's very left-footed. And really, you can say the same about Ozil. So when you have those two very left-footed players in midfield, to me, it's even more important that the third person is tactically intelligent enough to find positions to help those guys out.
Yeah, and I think what you saw from him was a lot more attacking play as well. He was making those forward passes. He got into the box a few times. So there definitely was a cohesive plan in that game. And so, like you said, I was excited to see the 4-3-3 because I was curious to see how it would work with Mesut Ozil. And it was something, you know, something we've talked about, like, can he really play in that sort of system? Because I think that's ultimately the system we need moving forward if you really want to compete against the best in England and the best in Europe, certainly.
We're a little bit of the ways off that.
Yeah, somehow that ship has sailed, unfortunately. You know, so, you know, definitely took some positives from that game. But like you said, it was West Ham. I think the fan base was just so eager for any sort of positive mojo that maybe after that game, we thought we were going to walk into Palace and take care of business pretty handily.
Well, after that game, the board should have come out and announced a 2-year extension for Arsene Wenger.
If they might not get another chance for the rest of the season. The way things are shaping up, probably not. And after that Palace game, oh boy. I don't even know where to go with that.
Well, full disclosure, I was working, following the game, following along on Twitter. They scored. I stopped following along on Twitter.
Yeah, no, but I avoided the result all day, got home.
God, that's some dedication, man.
You know, when I want to avoid a result, I'm actually very good at it. But it was obviously a waste of time in this instance, staying off the internet all day. You know, the game, we actually didn't start too badly. But then the goal we gave up was just, you know, such a typical Arsenal goal to give up. And then, you know, things kind of capitulated from there where nothing is working in an attacking sense. I think Xhaka and Monreal were our best players, but that wasn't saying a whole lot. I mean, Alexis was terrible. Welbeck missed chance after chance. Theo did what Theo does, and that's provide absolutely nothing other than an outlet, really. And, you know, the midfield struggled, you know, just with the way the game was being played. And to be fair, Palace has some good players, too. You know, we can't lose sight of that, but it's still Crystal Palace.
It's Palace. I mean, yeah. From what I saw, you know, I'm not taking any sort of analysis from what I saw people say on Twitter, because it's Twitter, it's Arsenal fans, and how you navigate your way through that to actually get to truth is, I mean, I don't think that's even possible. But the thing I did see about the game was one of those cool heat map and passing charts, graphs, whatever. You guys know what I'm talking about. And I looked at it, and you know, you can see we use the same 4-3-3 shape as the West Ham game, but you could barely find Theo and Welbeck's dot on that heat map. They were just completely useless. We were totally one-sided through Alexis. And when you do that, you're incredibly easy to defend. You're predictable. I mean, if the ball always goes into Alexis's feet, you know what he's going to do. When you don't have anybody on the other side of the field making themselves available, you're stuck. So I think that was one of those type of, which, you know, to me, it shows the real downfall of Arsene Wenger is that in the West Ham game, he found a tactic that worked. So he carried over the exact same tactic into the Palace game. But the thing about that is Palace saw the tactic that worked for us in the West Ham game and reacted in a way to affect us. You know what I mean? They knew what we were going to do and tried to take us out of it.
Yeah, and you know, the thing with Welbeck, and I can hold my hand up on this, you know, when he was getting healthy, I said, you know, he needs to start because he opens things up for Alexis and their movement and all this and that. But in a game like that, he was just so ineffective. And, you know, and I thought, you know, if Welbeck is starting, you know, if he's starting a striker, then Alexis won't just be cutting in from the left every single time. He'll be able to float a little bit. But, I mean, Alexis's game was so predictable. He lost the ball so many times just cutting in from his left onto his right. You know, there was no specific pattern of play to what we were trying to do. And Sam Allardyce, and I can't stand him just because he thinks he's so much smarter than he is, but literally his main job in life has been taking over awful teams and making them just slightly less awful. But in this instance, he said that, you know, in our setup, our fullbacks push up really high, our midfield leaves a lot of space behind, and then our center backs are kind of left on their own. And so, you know, what he did was hit those gaps behind and then, you know, put our center backs into those one-on-one positions. And that's kind of how Palace capitalized, unfortunately. And it doesn't help that Bellerin had one of his worst games as an Arsenal player. You know, it was a combination of a lot of different factors, but, you know, it's one of those things where I can't even say, oh, well, so-and-so was really bad, or, you know, so this is why we lost. I mean, it's just the same repetitive problems rearing their head. And, you know, I mean, for as much as I hate the, oh, no more, you know, need more passion or desire and all that, you know, cliched crap that English pundits say, in a game like this, like, there is a little bit of a gut check. Like, if things are going against you, you've got to find a way to rise up a little bit, to man up, and you can. And Theo said something after the game that rightfully angered a lot of Arsenal fans, where he said, we knew right from the off that they wanted it more than us. That, to me, does not compute. You know what I mean? I mean, when you hear something like that, what do you think? I mean, just taking it in the context of how it was said.
My thought with Theo's comments, I mean, first of all, I mean, it's, don't give me the professional athlete. Everybody needs to show up and play, because there really is something to it. And the same thing goes with the narrative, that passion narrative. It's for games like, you know, they say a rainy day at Stoke. When you play those mid-table teams, those lower-level table teams in the Premier League, you have to show up with passion. Like, you really do. And it's you can't just coast through it on your talent, especially when you're in the kind of form we are. But knowing that, like, as a player, knowing that things aren't going well for you, the one thing that you can really control is the amount of effort you put in a game. So that's, I wasn't sure how to take it, to be honest with you. You know, it's, the players are constantly coming out and saying, no, we love Arsene Wenger. We want him to be our manager. We're not quitting on him, anything like that. But then they come out and put that kind of a display in.
Yeah. And,
you know,
and
it's,
you're exactly right in that those two things are completely at odds. You say you're fighting for this manager, but then you show up with a performance like that. And before anyone gets confused, I'm not one of these passion merchants just talking about, you know, oh,
well, if this is, you know, your second time listening to our podcast, then you will know that neither of us are a passion merchant, as Alex so eloquently
said. You know, like, ultimately, I think in games like this, yeah, it's usually a tactical issue or a formation issue or a personnel issue, but when I saw how we played, it was hard not to look and say, where's the effort? Where's the, you know, commitment? You know, if we set up tactically the same way we did against West Ham, yes, obviously Palace adapted to that, like you said, but we still have the personnel to make things happen. And the giveaways and just the way their heads dropped after the first goal and just the mindless mistakes, you know, Mustafi, for one, was diving in recklessly, leaving space behind. And you know, going back to Theo's comments, when I heard that, I just, you know, I kind of shook my head and I said, like, how can you say that, you know? And then we'll hear these comments, you know, on the Arsenal website about how we need to bounce back and this and that. And it just all falls into these repetitive patterns. And, you know, and I can only speak for myself. Like, I'm just tired of hearing about it. Like, I don't want to hear how we're going to bounce back. I don't want to hear about, oh, you know, we're fighting for the manager. You know, enough talk. Just go do it. I realize these are these token interviews they have to do, but, you know, like, let's stop treating the fans like we're stupid, you know?
But isn't that the kind of the problem with the club right now? That everything is, it's still status quo. It's same old responses. It's same old tactics. It's same old results. I mean, for something to change, either the players, the manager, or the club need to change something, right? It's a definition of insanity. You do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result.
Right.
That's what I feel like this team has been doing for the last year and a half, or even longer, but whatever, fine, keep it strictly to this season. You know, they say that, oh, we've changed these tactics. But in reality, nothing has changed. Game to game, we set out with the same fragile mindset, the same attitude. And, I mean, we were getting bossed around in games early on in the season, and the results just kind of some late goals covered up for that.
You know,
for me, I don't see a difference. I don't see anything different in how we've played the last 2 months as to how we've played since game one.
It's funny you say that, because I completely agree. You know, other than, you know, like when Cazorla was in the lineup, you know, things did flow better. And you had that win against Chelsea, which ironically, and I might have mentioned this in a previous podcast, like, kind of set the two clubs in different directions, in the sense that it caused Chelsea to change, but then it also caused this complacency with Arsenal, where we're like, oh, see, we beat a big team and we did it convincingly. Now look what we're going to do. And we've got things ticking over in midfield, and oh, we're going to do it. And now we're grinding out results, you know, like Burnley at home or this and that. And so we're going to make this title run. And then the problem, well, not the problem, one of the problems is that if you had just read a report of Monday's game on, like, if you on Tuesday morning picked up your paper, read an article on the internet, and then you scaled back, I mean, you went back a year or you went back 2 years to like the same time period, you'd probably be reading a very similar report. You know, Arsenal gave up an early goal and then capitulated after that. And, you know, it's as much as I personally get frustrated by narratives that are pushed in the media, because I think a lot of them are BS and lazy. I do think this is one of them where there's a little bit of credence to those.
Yeah, there's certainly no way to disagree with that. I mean, it kind of ties into some of the latest comments that we've seen, out there. Going back to when Ivan Gazidis made his catalyst for change comments, you know, it's kind of getting interesting. And you know, let's be honest here. We know that there's a PR battle going on between Arsene's people and the club's people. There's no doubt about that. That's clear. But there's got to be. There's certainly something to be said for this. You know, if Arsene's going to stay, you know, he has to change. He's going to, you know, my takeaway from those comments, and we'll get yours, see what you think about that. But for me, it was the club is saying, Arsene, something needs to change. It's either going to, things are going to change. They are either going to change with you or without you. So fall in line. And make and agree to these changes and go along with it, or we'll make the changes without you. Now, that might be my optimistic side, hoping that that's really what the club is saying. But, and again, like I said, PR battle, but that's the vibe I got from it, at least.
I agree to an extent. I wouldn't even necessarily say it's the club and Wenger. I think it's Gazidis and Wenger, you know, like, the board has been very non-committal, so no one really knows what the board is doing or what they do in general. Kroenke,
not much of anything.
Kroenke has always been, you know, a very vocal Wenger supporter, you know, and basically telling, you know, not telling people, but just saying, like, look, I have a lot of faith in Arsene Wenger, and basically as long as Arsene meets these goals we've set out, then, you know, he's fine. I mean, that's more or less been the understanding, even if he hasn't said it. Gazidis is the one who seems to have been proactive with everything and saying, exactly like you said, you know, all of this needs to be a catalyst for change. I think he recognizes a problem, and I think he's the one been pushing Wenger to change. And, you know, just from all the reports that have come out, and like you said, it's PR. We don't know what's true and what's not. But it seems like Wenger is pushing back on changing, or, you know, not acknowledging the level of change that is needed and how the depth of change. You know, he probably thinks that there's just some minor tinkering that needs to be done. But, I mean, the whole club needs an overhaul. You know, I don't think people are grasping, you know, how deep the divide is with the club and how far we are from – where we want to be, you know. I mean, you're talking about things like the assistant coaches. I mean, nobody knows what Steve Bould does. You know, Gary Payton, the goalkeeping coach, I've never heard anything good about him. All our goalkeepers have regressed under him.
I mean, look at Chesney at Roma. I mean, okay, yeah, Serie A, but still.
No, but Chesney, like, I mean, hey, you can't hate on Serie A. It's one of my favorite leagues. But Chesney's literally turned into one of the best shot stoppers in the world, like, bar none.
Let's be honest about him, though. He's always been a great shot stopper. It's just...
But his decision-making and when to come out and things like that is all improved under a proper goalkeeping coach. So, you know, even the things like the training methods, you know, like when you've seen players leave the club and they say, oh, when I went to City under Pep, like, they do things so much differently. Or I went to this club and they do things this way. You know, it's not just what's on the pitch during the games. It's everything around it that's broken right now. And I think Gazidis recognizes that problem. The issue is, I think, just from everything I've read, is that he seems to be getting a lot of pushback from Wenger, and they've obviously butted heads. And I'm worried that, you know, he just might be like, look, this isn't worth it. Now, I kind of want to throw a question at you, though. I was having this discussion on Twitter with someone earlier today, and, you know, he brought up an interesting point where, like, do you think Wenger doesn't know how to change? Do you think he genuinely doesn't want to? Or do you think he's just so stubborn where he's thinking, look, I've won my way 10 years ago, but I know if I just get the right pieces, or if people are patient with me, then it'll happen. Like, my way is the way. You just need to be patient. Or do you just think, like, it's just genuinely like the game has passed him by and he just doesn't want to accept it?
I think it's a little bit of the last two. I don't think it's he doesn't know how to change, because, you know what, from the sounds of it, Gazidis knows, like, these reports are put out there by him saying, oh, there's issues with the coaches, there's issues with needing a sporting director. Like, all these reports, those are being fed by the club, by Gazidis. That's where they come from. So he, like, to me, that says that he understands, or him, or parts of the board, whatever, the club in general, understands that these are the things that need to change. For me, it's just a stubbornness on Wenger's part, that he thinks his way is the way to go, and he wants to prove that he can do it in today's game. I mean, it's one of those things where coaching is always something that adapts. We'll never know, because we don't know the man himself, but we'll never know if it's a he can't change versus a he won't change thing. You know what I mean? It's,
yeah. We can only go off of what we see, you know, and if you're seeing the same problems occur over and over, despite different personnel, you know, like, I saw someone make this point, and it kind of made me sad when I read it, but, like, we're not playing any better quality of football now with Alexis and Mesut Ozil and Granit Xhaka and these kinds of guys than we were when we were playing, like, Danielson or Alex Song in midfield. Like, has the quality of football improved at all?
You could argue it's gotten worse.
Right? Where's the flow in midfield? I mean, Ham game, where's the any flow in our attacking play?
When's the last time we scored a goal similar to the one that Jack Wilshere scored against Norwich City, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, the flick from Giroud, yeah.
One of the most ridiculous passing moves I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
When's the last time we scored a goal even close to that?
I mean, off the top of my head, the only one I can think of is Walcott's goal against Chelsea, you know, where there was some interplay with Ozil and Iwobi, and then they find Bellerin and then Walcott in the middle. But I can't think of, like, a great passing move that we've had, you know, back to front.
Yeah, I mean, this narrative of Wenger ball, you know what I mean? Like, that's...
It doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't, and it hasn't existed since Cesc was here.
It's true.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but on a consistent basis, I really don't remember where, you know, more than maybe a couple moves a game, we've seen this team pass and move and put together those kind of combinations. And that's where I really fall on the stumbling block, where is it the players? Is it the manager? Like, what is it? Because anything different.
That's the problem. He's right? not doing anything different.
Well, if he's not doing anything different, then shouldn't we still at least see our teams attempt to play that way? Like, let's just think about it. Like, how many times do you, when you're watching this team play, we have possession kind of on the boundary between the middle third and the final, or in the attacking third. Ozil's on the ball, or Monreal's on the ball on the left flank, and you see Alexis, Giroud, Walcott across the front, just standing still. The supporting midfielders standing still. There's no movement. And I can't even tell you the number of times I've wanted to throw my remote control through the TV watching this team stand still.
There is no movement. And the thing is, when there is movement, it's very predictable movement. You know, like I can and I'm no tactical expert, like I have no coaching background, but something, you know, like when we get the ball in certain parts of midfield or when the fullbacks get the ball, it's fairly obvious what we're doing. You know, like there's no creativity or spontaneity or like just an understanding between three or four players making a triangle. You know, four people can't make a triangle, but three players making a triangle to get out of tight spaces. You know, you'll see Bellerin get pinned on the right side. He'll pass back to Mustafi, you know, who will then find Koscielny, and then he'll pass to Monreal, who gets pinned on the left, pass it back. I mean, there's just like, you know, our play is so predictable. It's so easy to play against. So, you know, we complain like, oh, well, Palace just were lumping the ball forward or this and that. Well, yeah, but if you know what a team's going to do and you know exactly what's going to hurt that, wouldn't you do the same thing? You know,
if Palace is just lumping the ball forward, that how is that stopping us from playing the way that we want to play?
Because I mean, the way we want to play, we push everyone forward. You lump it forward, all of a sudden you're caught out numbers wise. Palace push their wingers forward, and then we're undone. You know?
Yeah. Well, and again, if that's the case, you clip a long ball to one of your wingers who stayed high. He gathers the ball, and you know what? You're in behind. Like,
but we don't have that. We don't have that spontaneity of thought anymore.
Right, and that's for me. That's been my biggest issue with what's happened in the last couple of years. I've talked about it before. The reason I'm an Arsenal supporter is the style that we play. But the last two seasons now, that's not how we play the game anymore. And that's been the most difficult thing for me.
Yeah.
It's not a fun, attractive style of football. I don't know what we're trying to do. So is that Arsene, has he made a change and said, you know what? I think I have, you know, let's take his words from preseason saying he's got the best squad he's had. Is that him saying, you know what? I have this good of a squad. I'm going to let them just go play. I mean, if that's the case, then at some point in time, he needs to step in and get things sorted out. But I don't know what it is.
See, I don't even think it's that he told them to go play. I think he has so much confidence in his philosophy that it's not just go play. It's just like, you know, he wants us to play a certain way, but you know, when that way is stifled, I don't think he knows what else to do. And I don't think you can blame the talent level of the squad. And I threw this question out on Twitter, like, do we overrate the quality of the squad? You know, maybe to some extent we do, but you should still be beating a team like Crystal Palace. And you look at what we've added to the squad in the past 2 years, let's say 2-3 years, you know, you had Mesut Ozil and Alexis before, but then you add a Swiss international in Granit Xhaka, a German World Cup winner in Shkodran Mustafi. You know, you've added quality pieces, so the talent is there, and I don't think that's an excuse. So, you know, it's about putting that talent in the right positions. I mean, these aren't bad players that are making mistakes. These are all good players, good international quality players. So if all these guys look so much worse in our current setup, I mean, isn't that down to one man?
You know, that's the thing, though. I don't excuse me. God damn. I don't see us trying to even play that style, though. You know, it'd be one thing if we were trying to play that creative, attractive style of football and, you know, guys were giving the ball away in tough spots, or they just weren't completing the passes they needed to complete, or didn't see the passes. We're not even moving into positions for those passes to even start. You know what I mean? I don't know that I really explained it all that well, but it's, for me, it's more of, it's not a skill level thing, because I think, I don't know that Wenger was wrong in saying, he's wrong in saying it was his best side that he's had, but in the last, I don't know, 8 years, have we had a more talented side?
No, I mean, from a talent perspective, it is the best squad he's had since probably the team that went to the Champions League final, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't think of anyone since any team since then that has been as talented. You know,
not from top to bottom, no.
No. And I guess I'm just, you know, for me, I'm having a difficult time getting to what I think really is the root of the problem, because, like I said, we have so much talent, but our guys aren't in the position to really do anything with that talent. And again, like you said, that comes down to the manager, or does that come down to the players?
I mean, for me, like, I got to say the manager, and I don't want to repeat myself because I know I don't want to linger on the point too long, but just the fact that it's, you know, we've changed personnel, you know, it's not a question of like, oh, well, this is the first team we've seen these issues with. Like, these issues have been there before, you know. You put Coughlin in midfield, you take him out, like, it's, you know, not much is changing, you know, or you put Alexis up top, or you put Giroud up top, or, you know, you play Monreal instead of Gibbs, or, you know, you play Theo or Ox, you know, it really isn't changing
the ultimate outcome. I think the one thing that really changed there is when we put Alexis up top, which for me, Arsene's biggest fault this season is not continuing with that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree to an extent. I mean, the way the setup was against Chelsea, you know, and I'm just using that as an example because that was the only really meaningful result we had this season, honestly, you know, where Alexis played up top, you had Iwobi wide left, Theo wide right, and then you had Cazorla, Coughlin, Ozil in midfield. You know, regardless of my thoughts about Coughlin, I mean, that game worked because Cazorla was in midfield, but then you had your wide creator in Iwobi, and then a goal scorer out wide in Theo who could complement Alexis. So you had Iwobi tucking into midfield and giving that extra number, so we maintained control while still posing attacking threat. So, you know, but it's a question of like, I don't know if Wenger sees Alexis as a number nine. I don't, or maybe he just put him there because Giroud is, you know, we had Welbeck out and Giroud just wasn't working, or, and so kind of the point that I saw debated was, you know, well, if Wenger really sees Alexis as a wide left player, losing him isn't as big a blow than if you saw him as a striker, because good strikers are so rare to find. Whereas, you know, wide players that can score, it's tougher, but there are some at least.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that point. If Arsene does see Alexis as a primarily a wide player, which, God, if he really does think that, I must not know a thing about football, because he's so much better in the middle of the pitch. But, you know, if that's the case, and Arsene is going to be around, then it's not that big of a loss. Then if you can sell him for $60 million, then I think the number I saw today was City was linked with him in a $64 million bid. You know, just whatever. If you're going to sell him for that, then you know what? You're selling a wide player for $64 million. So, shit, go for it.
Well, preferably not in the league, though.
Well, yeah. So, well, that's. I think that goes without saying that.
Yeah, no, selling to PSG.
If you're selling him to City, you better get 100 mil for him.
Yeah. If you're selling him to PSG and they offer you 60 million, you might consider taking it, honestly, because you're going to lose him for free next season. There's a very good chance, given the way he plays, that he's going to hit a hill and then just drop off. Because his legs can only support so much of what he does. And in terms
of the rest ever either.
Yeah, so like he's due for that sort of dip. And in terms of the way he plays, if you're going to play him wide right, he's, you know, he kind of delays any sort of fast, fluid football because he receives the ball on the left and then cuts in and then kind of dribbles around too much. You know, when he played up front, that's when we played our best stuff because it was just so reactive, you know, like it's just like boom, boom, boom. You're moving. He makes a run. He scores. He drops deep and then other guys go kind of behind him. On the left, it slows everything down. So if you're going to play him wide right at least because then he can dribble in naturally on his right foot and then cross it in or, you know, provide an added threat in the air, you know, to a cross coming in from the left. But if you really see him wide left, then, you know, I guess it's not ideal to sell him, but then I guess do it that way and then buy an elite striker and then, you know, buy a guy like Insigne wide left. You know, a guy who's good in possession and could still contribute goals as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if, like you said, if Arsene is going to, and again, we're kind of assuming that Arsene is going to be back next year, whatever, apply the same concept. If Allegri comes in and he sees Sanchez as a wide left player as a flank player, sell him. Because you know what, if you can get $65 million for a winger, whatever, take that 65 plus another 30 and go and buy Mbappe.
At the rate he's going to be way above 95 million.
He's going to go for that much.
I really think he could go for 120 million.
Wow.
Pounds, not dollars, pounds.
That would be incredible. I mean, I've. Jesus. So what? He's going to United or he's going to.
I see him going to.
Real Madrid.
I see
for that money?
For Real Madrid, I see Real Madrid or United. I can't. Because if Ibrahimovic leaves, United.
United's going for our Griezmann.
I mean, they conceivably could get both. That's the kind of financial firepower they have. But I could see Real Madrid doing it because Benzema's, you know, hitting that peak where I think he's kind of on the downside of his career. And, you know, there are only a select few clubs that can afford him, let's be honest. You know, Barcelona, I don't think it makes sense for them to do it because their front three is still – as dynamic as there is. Yeah. Bayern Munich, I don't see where he'd fit. You know, Real Madrid makes sense. United makes sense. But regardless, so, you know, if not Mbappe, I mean, you have to spend on an elite player because if you're losing an elite player, you can't just replace them with crap, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you're taking Alexis and you're taking that money, flipping it and turning it into a world-class striker or a young striker who is on the verge of becoming a world-class striker like Mbappe, you know, 12 months ago.
And we did bid for Mbappe 12 months ago. That's the sad part.
Would we bid like, if we try and bid $1 more?
I mean, I don't know what we bid. I know Wenger said that we did actually put a bid in, but I mean, it's gonna go down.
You know, the thing about that is Monaco probably said, you know what? Guys, give us 25 million and we'll give them and you can have them. And we said,
I think we bid 35, I want to say.
We wouldn't. There's no way we bid that much for a player who was that young.
I'm going to look that up, actually.
I hope you're right and that we did bid 35 because then it makes us look better. where if they had said, hey, give us 25 or 30, and we said, you know what, we'd rather pay 15.
No, it was definitely more than that.
Okay. Well, I hope you're right. I haven't seen it.
But regardless, you know, the other thing we've seen is the infamous transfer war chest stories, you know, where, oh, Arsene Wenger has 200 million pounds to utilize this summer, you know, to retool the squad. Like, bullshit. This, we hear this every season. Every season we hear this, like, when things go south. It's like it's a PR release, but I mean, it's just one of those things that kind of comes out when it's clear that Alexis is going to leave, and I'm leaning towards Ozil leaving at this point.
You know, I'm not there yet on him. I'm definitely there on Alexis being gone. I think when Alexis leaves, we turn all of our attention to Ozil and make sure we keep him. I don't think we can afford to lose both guys. You know, unless the club is ready to spend the next, you know, kind of do what Liverpool did and spend a couple of years finishing outside the top four, which I don't think our club is and the board is prepared to do.
Well, I also don't think we can recruit the kind of players we want without Champions League. We're not United or Chelsea or City where we have a financial firepower.
No, we can't compete with those teams, but you know, we talked about it before. We're still a top 12 club in the world in terms of a draw. Even without Arsene Wenger. You know, if it is Allegri or
it's not gonna be Allegri.
I don't wanna see Tuchel in here at all. We can kind of touch on that a little bit when we hit Champions League. I have some major issues with him, so I will be incredibly upset if he's our guy. But whatever, and I don't know anything about who it's going to be, but Allegri just was the name to throw out there.
Oh God, can you imagine leaving a squad with Paulo Dybala and Higuain and Bonucci and Chiellini to come and watch Olivier Giroud. I mean, to coach Olivier Giroud and Danny Welbeck. I mean, I could not see him leaving. And
I mean, he can bring all those guys with him.
Oh, that would be ideal. It's funny because
just bring Dybala with you, please.
I mean,
please.
I know that before Dybala signed for Juventus, I know that he said like, "Look, if I go to a club in England, it'd be Arsenal." But I think he always wanted to stay in Italy. But it's just another one of those, oh, what if moments. Like if you just paid over the odds a little bit for a guy like Dybala, who was clearly on the cusp of stardom and now is a full-fledged star.
Oh, I know for a fact that we talked about him last summer on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like before he went to Juventus and shortly after. We're like
2 summers ago.
Sorry, 2 summers ago, yeah. I know maybe even last summer, like guys wide. Same kind of conversation we're having about Mbappe right now.
You know, and we're going to have a lot of these what if conversations, you know?
You know, that's kind of the thing. Like, is that something that a sporting director can help fix? You know, maybe Arsene isn't able to spend quite as much time looking at these players. And I don't know, you know?
But see, I don't.
I know it's kind of a weird jump to get there, but
I don't buy that he doesn't have enough time to scout the players, because like we've talked about Xhaka, like Xhaka was scouted like 30 times, you know, and he said like we've watched Mbappe all these times. It's not that he's not watched them, but at some point, like you have to accept that you're gonna pay over the odds to get a guy that could potentially be a star, because the way I see it, like we can't sign ready-made stars.
No, we can't. We can't compete on the wage scale.
You know, so exactly the wage issue. So, and the fee issue, even like we're not going to pay like 70 million pounds for a player.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is we could, but when you pay 70, 80 million pounds for a player, you're also paying 300 million or 300K a week.
Yeah. So your best bet if you're Arsenal is to identify guys who are going to become stars and take a gamble and to be frank, hope they pay off. I mean, you know, look at the guys at Monaco. I mean, you telling me we couldn't use 4 or 5 of those guys?
Just give me all the young players from Monaco and Dortmund. And
If we lost Ozil and Sanchez, but we brought in Bernardo Silva or, you know, Thomas Lamar or Bakayoko or, you know, obviously Mbappe, but Mbappe is kind of in his own category. Mbappe won't happen. But if you get like a guy like Bernardo Silva, you know, and then, you know, pair him with, I mean, I don't know who's going to be available in the striker market, but pair him with one of these young up and coming strikers, then, you know, maybe you've got something. But there are so many holes in this team. And the problem is, even if we spent $200 million, would you feel confident saying like, oh, well, that'll fix it if Arsene Wenger stays in charge?
For me, and God, it pains me to say it, but no, it wouldn't be enough if Arsene was still in charge. Because ultimately, I don't see us needing to spend that much money. I think this team needs a new left back. It needs wingers. Give me one world-class winger. Play Alexis Central. And so give me a left back, a winger, and another Cazorla-style player. I don't think that costs you – that doesn't cost you $200 million. That's going to cost you $80 million. You know, give me somebody like a young center midfielder like Tielemans. God, absolutely butchered that name, I'm sure.
No, it was pretty good, actually. I thought that was good.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'll take that.
Or Naby Keita. Like, get me Naby
which,
Keita.
Okay, I'm going to say it. I saw, was it Tielemans was linked with Dortmund?
It was linked with Monaco.
Oh, was it Monaco? Whatever. Either way, the two top clubs in the world in terms of identifying talent, like youth talent.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a sporting director, Arsenal, there you go. Go take theirs because those guys are on top of their shit.
The name I saw thrown around was Mark Overmars, you know, former Arsenal player. He's at Ajax right now. That'd be a good one. I saw that they were looking at Arsenal's, you know, international scouting director to be the sporting director. I mean, I think those are two different things. Being able to scout and being able to close deals are two different things.
Absolutely.
You know, so like you want someone like you said, like Dortmund or Monaco, get whatever they're doing. Because think about it. Dortmund identified guys like Ousmane Dembele, you know, obviously Christian Pulisic, you know, guys like that. I think
Paslak, Guerrero, Weigl.
Oh my god, Guerrero's a fucking star.
Dude, that goal he scored against Munich.
I mean, ooh,
that strike was insane.
And Arsenal showed interest in Guerrero, but just didn't close the deal. You know, you have to be willing to do that. And so, but like you said, like, we're talking about spending so much. I don't, you know, ultimately it's just, you got to clear the stuff up at the top of the club before you even concern yourselves with who we're going to buy, because ultimately it's just going to be a cycle. You know, we thought what we needed was this controlling midfielder. So we signed Xhaka and a center back to pair with Koscielny, so we signed Mustafi. Well, the same issues are still appearing. We signed those players, though. You know, I mean, am I being too negative here? I mean, perk me up a little bit here. You've always been the more optimistic of us. I need that right now.
That's a lot of pressure, and unfortunately, I've got nothing for you, because what's the common denominator there? The common denominator is Arsene Wenger. That pains me so much to say that, but he's a common denominator. He's the one that has been there through all of these personnel changes where we've seen no difference. He's the one that has missed out on all these players that we've shown interest, but you know what? We don't want to pay the extra $5 million, $10 million. You're Arsenal. You have money.
Yeah.
The board in the club isn't saying, Arsene, no, you cannot spend this money on that player. They say, here's a shit ton of money, go spend it. It's up to you, completely you. Do what you want to do with that money.
It's not an issue of not having funds anymore.
No. I mean, like we said, we can't compete with, you know, the top six or seven clubs in terms of transfer fees and wages. But other than those those teams were on the same level as anybody else in the world.
And, you know, you contrast that kind of transitioning, like we're talking about teams that are well-run. Contrast that with Juventus. I mean, I understand Serie A is a different beast just because Juventus is kind of the king of the castle there. But, you know, transitioning to the Champions League, because I forgot how much fun it is to watch actually functional teams play, you know, teams with a clear setup and structure. So I watched that Juventus-Barcelona game yesterday. And, I mean, Juventus just – they're so tactically well-drilled. They press as a unit. They know when to sit back as a unit. They play their offside lines correctly. Defensively, they stick tight to their man. When guys go forward, someone else sits back. You know, their wingers, you know, tuck in when they need to, but also stay wide when they need to. And so much of that is down to Allegri. I mean, obviously, they scout players really well. When you bring in a guy like Pjanic over the summer, or Khedira, or, you know, Dybala two summers ago, or Higuain this past summer. You know, obviously it's easy when all the Italian clubs sell you whoever. But even so, Allegri has put these guys in a position to succeed. Like, you have Mandzukic playing as a left winger. You know, Mandzukic is the prototypical target forward, but he put him as on the left wing because Mandzukic works hard for the team. And, you know, provides something different out wide and provides a defensive work rate, but also an additional aerial threat. And, you know, they bamboozled Barcelona. I mean, that midfield of Pjanic and Khedira and then Dybala tucking in completely bossed the game, controlled it from start to finish. And Dybala was so clinical with his finishes. I mean, that game could have been 4-5-0, honestly. I mean, Barcelona had chances as well, but Higuain missed quite a few chances. And, you know, I know you didn't get to see the game, but just like, you know, obviously you're, you know, familiar with Allegri and the way he sets his team up. I mean, does it frustrate you where you're like, look, that's what a good team should look like? You don't need a Messi or Ronaldo. You can still have a well-drilled team of very good players.
Yeah, that's definitely what, like, for me, I want to see my team set up in a way that looks like we actually prepared for the game. And that's something you can never say about Juventus. I mean, Jesus, anytime you see them play, they have a game plan. They're set up in the right places to execute that game plan, and they go out and try and execute it. Like, sure, sometimes they don't, or the game plan isn't quite right, and they don't win every game. But there's a clear objective that their team sets out with. And that's the thing. That's the most frustrating thing about, you know, tying it back to Arsenal as we do with everything. That's the most frustrating thing for me. It's awesome to watch, but it's also incredibly frustrating because it reminds you, like, man, we don't ever do this, and we're so far away from where we ultimately want to be or should be.
Yeah, I mean, the gap is so noticeable when you watch them play because, you know, when Juventus players got pressed, they were so composed on the ball too, you know, and another player would make themselves available and they'd maneuver their way out of tight spaces. Or if they had to play it long, they played it long, but they played it long with a purpose. You know what I mean? Sometimes I feel when our guys get pressed, they just kind of lump it forward just so they can catch their breath. You know, Juventus could play it long, but they play it long to a Mandzukic, or they play it long to a Cuadrado making a run with his speed. You know, so they have so many different ways to beat you. And it was just such a marked difference from how we play. And I mean, you know, even watching some of the other Champions League games, you know, I watched Real Madrid and Bayern Munich today. And I mean, Bayern Munich destroyed us. And Real Madrid looked really comfortable against them. I mean, it was 2-1. So, you know, the tie is still open going into Madrid. But, you know, you got to make Madrid the clear favorites there. Especially if Lewandowski's still hurt for Bayern. Well, but
I'm just looking at some of the stats for that game. And Madrid had 23 shots, 12 on goal, to Bayern's 9 shots and 2 on goal. So while the score was close, the game itself really probably wasn't. I mean,
that could have been way worse. Benzema had 4 or 5 chances to put that tie away.
Sounds about right for him.
You know, Thomas Muller played up front in place of Lewandowski. He struggled a little bit. Arjen Robben was great, and Vidal was great for Bayern. But then Javi Martinez, he got two yellow cards in the span of 3 minutes in the middle of the second half. I think
how
it was around
that.
And they were bad. I mean, they were clear yellows.
Yellow in the 58th and the second yellow in the 61st. So, yeah, 3 minutes.
Yeah, so, you know, they played 30 minutes down a man. And Madrid probably should have put the tie away. They had chances. Ronaldo actually looked like he got hurt at the end of the game. I don't remember. I didn't see an update as to whether, you know, whether it was just a minor issue or what. But, you know, Ronaldo with two really nicely taken goals. And, you know, I think it was karma because, you know, Vidal, you know, Bayern got a very favorable penalty call in the, I think it was the end of the first half or early second half. I don't remember. Vidal missed and blasted it over the bar. And then, you know, Real Madrid came back and won the game and took control of the tie. And you'd have to put them as the favorites. But, you know, Bayern might pull something in Madrid. You never know. The other two ties I didn't get a chance to watch, unfortunately. I saw that Atletico beat Leicester 1-0, which was actually more closer than I expected. But at the same time, that means Leicester has to go on the attack in Leicester, chasing a goal against one of the best defending teams in the world.
Looking at the stats from that game, Leicester had 6 attempts, none on goal. Madrid had 15 attempts, 4 on goal, 36 to 11 as far as crosses for Madrid. And clearances were 28 for Madrid, 67 for Leicester. I don't have a possession number, but based on kind of how it looks, I mean, Madrid's only goal came on a penalty. I mean, that's to me that Leicester is lucky to get out of there 1-0.
Yeah, I mean, they're still in it, at least. That's the least you can say.
Yeah, and you know what? Wouldn't that be great for us to be able to say about our team in anything right now?
Oh, God,
I want to be involved in something.
I don't even remember what that feels like, honestly.
Such a sad existence as a sports fan.
Quick side
note.
Not
only is it Arsenal, I'm also a, never mind, we're not going there.
Yeah,
sorry, your side note.
I won't open that wound for you. Don't worry.
I don't need you to. It's already open all the time.
But talking about Real Madrid Bayern, I just want to, just because I just thought about it. You know, people keep saying Cristiano Ronaldo's done. No, he's done. He's down. Dude scores when it matters. I'm sorry. Like, you can hate him because he's everything that most of us are not. But he scores.
Rich, incredibly good looking, athletic. Yeah.
Yeah. He's basically what I want to be. He is what I want to be. So, I mean, people who hate on him and, you know, because of his persona, I mean, he's still one of the three best players in the world, no doubt. But anyways,
well, you know, right, kind of where you're at with that. It's kind of an interesting discussion that I briefly ventured into today on Twitter about Ronaldo and Messi in terms of when they start aging. You know, it's not anything we're going to get into now, but bold prediction, hot take. I think Cristiano Ronaldo's numbers could get better as he gets older.
Because you think he transitions to a number nine?
I think he transitions to a number nine in the style of somebody like Zlatan, where the mobility goes away a little bit, but he's just so incredibly lethal anywhere near the area that he's not going to be picking the ball up 40 yards from goal and running at goal. He's going to be in the box and the ball is going to come in and he's going to finish.
And he's a terrific finisher, you know.
He's an incredible finisher. And that's certainly, like I said, it's a conversation for the summer, but
no, but like, you look at a guy like him, he can head the ball, he can score with both feet. He's a decent enough passer, you know. He's not an elite passer, but decent enough passer. I mean, he has all the tools to be. It sounds weird to say all the tools because that's like something you say about a young player. He can transition his game to that spot. I agree. Just getting to the other Champions League tie, Dortmund and Monaco, I mean, certainly after what happened yesterday, nobody at Dortmund's minds could have been fully on this game. Like, yeah, Monaco probably could have won this game regardless, but I don't think Dortmund was all there. I did see some of the highlights afterwards, and, you know, 3-2 is not an undoable task to overturn in Monaco, especially because it's not like Monaco has like a crazy home field advantage, but it'll be tough for Dortmund. But I'm upset I didn't get to watch that whole game because it is one of the ties I was looking forward to, but certainly, you know, things bigger than football took precedence. I mean, I think it was insane that they were asked to play today. I mean, is it just me? Like, is that insane to ask a team that someone literally tried to kill all of them yesterday and then you say, go play a game today?
No, I'm with you. That seems a little crazy that they were forced to play. But it's definitely not an insurmountable task. I mean, they're down. Let's just throw a little plug out there for our boy. They're down 2-0, and they brought Pulisic on at halftime, and he changed the game. Just, you know, I didn't see it, so I can't say that for sure, but every single person on Twitter that was talking about that game, even French media people, were like, this Pulisic kid, like, holy shit, he's good.
That's the thing. It's not just he's a good American player. He's an elite world youth talent.
Well, I'm exactly on those lines. How many people did we see come out, maybe was it a week or two ago, that talked about him and said, like, not American, they were European based people, former players, managers, people like that, that said this kid has the potential to be as good as he wants to be. Like, he can be something that American soccer has never even come close to seeing. And he has all the talent in the world to become one of the best players in the world.
Oh, he does have the talent. Absolutely. It's tough because you don't want to pile all the nation's hopes on one player, especially when he's surrounded by...
Well, we don't have a choice.
Well, but he's surrounded by crap when he goes to the national team. Like, imagine playing with Julian Weigl and Shinji Kagawa and Gonzalo Castro and
Marco Reus and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Yeah, Aubameyang and Dembele and Emre Moore and Rafael Guerrero. And then you come to the U.S. national team setup, you see Michael Bradley, you see whatever a Dax McCarty is.
Bobby Wood and Fabian Johnson.
Bobby Wood, Jozy Altidore, you have old man Dempsey. I mean, like, it's just a shit show. And it's funny when people say, oh, well, you know, he's still got to earn the respect of his fellow U.S. teammates. You know, he's still a young player.
He's done that.
I'm like, first of all, why would anyone need to earn Michael Bradley's respect? Jesus Christ. Like, I'm sorry. If I see that bald moron turn the ball over one more time in midfield under no pressure.
And if you're an American national team player and you haven't given this kid your respect, like, get the hell out of here, man. Come on. He's doing stuff right now that nobody in our history has done. I mean, okay, fine. Maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration. But
no, it's not, though. It's really
like
not.
Fine. At his age, you watch him play, and the kid is remarkable. Now, I didn't mean to take it off on a Pulisic tangent. I just wanted to get a plug in there for
everyone. No. But, like, I think it's a good topic to touch on because, you know, we didn't get a chance to talk about the World Cup qualifiers for the U.S., you know, we beat Honduras at home and everyone's like, oh, great. You know, we turned it around. Look at Bruce Arena's effect. Then we go on the road and draw to Panama. I just want to point out Klinsmann beat Honduras at home and won on the road at Panama. So it's not like Bruce has done anything Klinsmann didn't do. But I just want to stick on the Pulisic thing for a little while just because he has been the talk of the town for U.S. soccer fans. First of all, and I know I'm going on all sorts of tangents and rants, but just
you know what? We're rusty. It's been a while.
Well, it's funny when people
we're all over the place tonight.
People will say like, look at American soccer. We've got like Pulisic doing his thing for Dortmund. And then like in the same sentence, they'll talk about like Jordan Morris or Kellen Acosta. I'm like, let's not put these two in the same paragraph.
No.
One is doing it for one of the best clubs in the world in the biggest competition in the world. And the others are doing it in MLS. And no one can see the hand motions I'm doing, but I've got Pulisic up here and then the rest down here. Yeah. So you know, from a U.S. perspective, and I don't know how much of those games you got to check out, but like, you know, certainly the performance against Honduras was a good one. You know, 4-0 is obviously, was it 4-0 or 6-0? I think it was 4-0.
I thought Dempsey had a hat trick. You keep talking and I will look that up.
Yeah, I thought Dempsey had a hat trick, but I don't remember exactly.
Right, yeah. I think he had at least two, and they were both set up by Pulisic.
That might be right, yeah. You know, so just from that perspective, you know, we're going to make the World Cup. 6-0, there we go. We're going to make the World Cup. I don't think there's a doubt about that. Like, I don't think, you know, the fact that Klinsmann was fired after two of our three hardest games really doesn't, you know, like, I don't think it kind of covers over the fact that we would have still likely qualified, but you know, it is what it is. Bruce is the coach, and I'll support him and the team and certainly want us to do well.
I'll support the team, but I won't support him.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think I can support Bruce as an individual because of what he said about foreign players and just the fact that he's just such an MLS shill, you know.
Well, just look at his comments about we're going to stay on the Pulisic hype train when he said that, you know, that we developed him at home. I mean, okay, sure. He went to Germany when he was, what, 15, 16?
15, I think.
15, yeah. If that sounds right. His claim was, oh, we did more for him developmentally than Germany, and that he would have been the same player if he stayed here.
No, he wouldn't have, Sunshine. No. Sorry.
Not like, I can't even, there's not a chance in hell that I'm ever going to get behind somebody that says that. I mean, what, so he's going to play in rural Pennsylvania? Playing for some club teams in region, you know, in region one, like, come on, versus playing in Dortmund's youth academy and their youth team playing against Bayern Munich's youth team. You're telling me it's the same level, like, that we did the majority of the work here for him? Are you kidding me?
It's part of this, like, you know, it's the Bruce Arena, Alexi Lawless crowd that everything in American soccer is great. We're doing everything great. We're developing great players, and how we do things is fine. You know, let's not acknowledge any flaws in what we do. And we don't want to make it seem like Europe is better than us at soccer or football. Well, you know, newsflash, it is.
I think it's funny because when going into those World Cup qualifiers, they're talking about the future of U.S. soccer. Christian Pulisic and Darlington Nagby. Nagby's what, 26?
26 years old, yeah.
Like, what? How are you comparing 18-26? Like, no. You can't even say the future of U.S. soccer, Christian Pulisic and Bobby Wood. Bobby Wood's like 23. I mean, okay, fine. Maybe you can. That's like the boundary of where you can put that comparison.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny because he's 26 and only now getting his first U.S. Like, obviously, he only became a citizen recently. I get that. But, like, he's still only performing in MLS. It's not like he's been doing this for good teams, you know, Nagby. So,
but he's not even performing, like, as far as a new player. He's not developing. Like, all the hype was that, you know, Darlington Nagby's, you know, can he develop with Christian Pulisic to become one of the leading players on the team? Well, no. He is what he is, and it's nothing special.
Well, I don't think U.S. fans understand the concept that by age 22 or 23, you should have already been hitting your peak or at your peak, you know? You look at some of the elite talents around the world. I mean, look at Mbappe, 18 years old, you know, Bernardo Silva, I don't know how old he is, but I think he's like early 20s.
That's, I mean, 21 at the oldest.
Silva's 22. Okay, so that's that age where you really should be making a difference. You had Mario Götze scoring the game-winning goal in the World Cup at age like 20 or 21, something like that.
Well, look at, I mean, Ousmane Dembele is 19. Rafael Guerrero is like maybe 20. Julian Weigel's 21. I know we're just going Bakayoko from Monaco's 21.
Yeah, so like we have this idea that, oh, well, our guys are young. We've got this young squad, 25, 26. No, the future comes way earlier than that. And that's what we don't get here. So, like, you know, right now, if you look at the makeup of the U.S. squad, I mean, Michael Bradley is, like, approaching 30, I think.
Jesus, he's that old now?
Yeah, what is he? He's 29. Altidore is 27. You know, so you've got 29-year-old and 27-year-old that are your key pieces, both of whom are playing their trade in MLS because they couldn't hack it abroad, you know, and these are the cornerstones of your team.
I mean, just looking kind of just flipping through Real Madrid right now, Isco is 24, James Rodriguez is 25, and those guys are not considered young anymore.
I know, and they're considered like disappointments now.
Casemiro's 25, and he broke into the team, but he's kind of seen as a late developer, you know?
Yeah.
And that's at Bayern Munich.
Yeah, what, Kingsley Coman's, what, 20 or 21?
21. When did, like, how old was, you know, Neymar when he made his move to Barcelona?
Yeah, it's, so, you know, this idea that somehow, like, these 26-year-old guys on our squad are still youngsters. It's just missing the plot completely. And I know we kind of went on tangent, but just with Pulisic.
Right. How the hell did we end up?
Oh, no, we're talking about the average age of the Bayern Munich squad. But with Pulisic, like, I'm so excited to watch him develop. I get more excited watching him play for Dortmund than I do with the U.S. because I fear for him with the U.S. that all these expectations are going to be put on him to be the savior, but you can't be the savior if you don't have good talent around you. And so, like, I feel like if things go wrong, they'll all put the blame on him, you know, because he's the golden boy. They won't single out their MLS guys, of course.
But for me, he's the kind of guy that can handle that type of pressure. He's come up playing for, he'll come up playing for Dortmund, starting in Der Klassiker for, you know, against Bayern Munich, starting in the Champions League against some of the top teams in the world. You can put all the pressure in the world on this kid. I don't think it's going to faze him. But that's because of the environment he was in when he started making it onto the scene, where his every move is criticized and watched by the world. If he's coming in MLS, shit, if he's playing for Seattle, the only people looking at you are the 40,000 Sounders fans in Seattle.
That's true, yeah. You're not facing the same pressure, obviously.
No. I mean, it's close. Dortmund, Seattle, the pressure's about the same, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, they're
starting against Bayern Munich
versus
starting against Portland.
Yeah, or starting against whatever the Vancouver Whitecaps are. Apparently, that's a thing.
LA Galaxy.
Yeah, or LA Galaxy, yeah.
Let's go there.
You know, so, and I'm not, and again, like, I we've gotten accused of, like, denigrating MLS. I mean, we're using it as an example to poke a little bit of fun at the fact that soccer coverage here is just so inconsistent with how things are treated, like where we don't acknowledge the different levels of play that players are at. Like, you know, if we have players in MLS that can contribute to the U.S. national team, then, you know, that's awesome. But let's not downgrade what Pulisic is doing by associating it with these other things, is my general point that I eventually came all the way around to get to.
It took us a while, but we got there. I think that was like a 15-minute little tangent that, well, you're never getting those 15 minutes of your life back.
I mean, to be fair, there was some good stuff in there.
I hope so.
Yeah. No, but just, you know, just kind of wrapping up, the next set of World Cup qualifiers for the U.S. Looks like June 8th. We play Trinidad and Tobago, and then we go away to Mexico.
So that'll win and loss.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine. Yeah, we split those most likely.
Yeah, I don't think there's any. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we covered a lot of ground today. I know we haven't been on in a little while, so, you know, you know, certainly schedules get in the way. We both of us have been pretty swamped with work, but you know, also candidly with Arsenal, we can only rant so much before we start to sound repetitive.
That's
how I feel, at least.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I was kind of hoping that something would happen. You know, we almost recorded something last week. And I'm like, you know what? Let's hold off for a week because maybe something will happen with Arsene Wenger and we'll have something different to talk about other than what is wrong with this club and how do we fix it.
Just last thing, does it shock you that he has not made a decision yet and is basically holding this club hostage?
I'm not shocked that he wants to wait. I'm shocked the club is allowing him to hold them hostage like that.
Because, I mean, ultimately everything at the club is in limbo because of this.
Yeah, 100%. And it's crazy from a business standpoint to let one man hold your club that hostage. That's just crazy.
Yeah. Oh, last thing before we wrap up. You mentioned a Thomas Tuchel story, or not the Thomas Tuchel story, but your frustration that he'd be a candidate for a managerial position. And I need to hear this.
He overcomplicates. Just like even when he did against Bayern, you know that Munich likes to attack with their wingers, with Ribery and Robin. So you play a three-man back line and leave space on those flanks. Like, to me, that's crazy. You try and get more people in midfield and try and maybe, I don't know, I think they went with a 3-4-3 to try and maybe exploit the space that Alaba leaves, but they didn't try and exploit that. I don't know. For me, that's just one of the things. And he did the same thing against now I'm blanking on the other game that he did the same kind of thing. May have been Bayern against Bayern earlier in the season, where instead of just going out with it, with what they normally do, it's like you try and be cute and overcomplicate and you just overthink things.
Do you not like that type of football he plays, though?
No, I generally love it. It's generally very attacking-minded. It's fast-paced. I love watching them play.
Yeah.
But in big games, he gets skittish. He tries to change things. And like I said, like, look at your opponent. Look at what your opponent likes to do. Ribery, Robin, they attack the flanks. So you leave the flanks vulnerable. Like, man, come on. It's a rookie mistake. And he's done that time and time again.
No, I got you. I feel you on that. You know, we'll see. I mean, certainly the manager spot is not something we're going to have to worry about for two more years, unfortunately. So we'll have a whole new set of candidates, I'm sure.
You bite your tongue right there.
I mean, I know the extension is coming. I'm just bracing myself. And
after we beat Sunderland?
Oh, God. That's probably what's going to happen, honestly. Oh, well, we're on the right track now, so let's announce this. But I'm thinking by the next, you know, hopefully by the next time we get a chance to speak and get something out to everyone, a decision will have been made. Either way, put us out of our misery. It's at the point where it's not fun anymore. I'll put it that way.
At this point in time, we're not getting a decision until the season's over.
That's
kind of where we're at. We're not getting a decision until after the season's over. And like you said, that's kind of a scary thought.
Because
if Arsene Wenger's held them hostage this long, he's going to continue to hold them hostage until the season's over. There's no reason why that would change. Or until, like you said, or like I said, they beat Sunderland and they say, hey, everybody's happy we beat Sunderland, so Arsene Wenger, two more years.
Yeah. Well, get ready for it, guys. Certainly we'll be here to break it down when it happens. But Ian, if you want to take this opportunity to wrap up. And
sorry, I just had to get myself off mute there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. It took us a couple weeks to get back out here. But yeah, come on, you Gunners. Let's get some wins. Let's get back in the top four and somehow find a way to please God finish above Tottenham. please, I don't care if we finish fifth, let them finish sixth. We cannot let them finish ahead of us. No matter what, that needs to be goal number one the rest of the year.
Amen to that. But
hire a hitman to you know, twist all their ankles so they can't play for the next 2 months.
Or just give them bad lasagna, like, you know, what happened all those years ago.
Okay, fine. I went a little crazier than the bad lasagna thing. But
you kind of went dark there.
A little bit, but I saved it with the twisting ankle things.
And, yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. They take PEDs. They'd be back within 2 weeks anyway.
That's allegedly, of course.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not accusing anyone of anything. Cough enhancement, but...
Sorry, hurricane.
Something in my throat, but yeah. But yeah, folks, you can find me on Twitter at UFGoonerAJ. You can find the podcast at facebook.com/EuroSnobPod and twitter.com/EuroSnobPod. Ian, how can the folks find you?
At GunnersFan6.
All right, folks. Well, that's it for me. Ian, any final thoughts?
I think we said plenty in this episode for you guys.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. All right, well, have a good one, guys.
Yeah, you too. Take care, guys.